everybody, it's Kai Rizdahl. Oh, wait, Molly's not here. Molly's on vacation, someplace fun, hopefully funner than I was on my vacation, but that's a whole different thing. So it's me for 2 weeks. It is me for 2 weeks, and it's not really just me, actually. It's you and me, because, wait, here it comes. None of us is as smart as all of us. Here is what we are going to do today. We are going to take you through the magic of radio and audio and a really cool podcast back to 1998. And you might be thinking now, well, let's see, what was 1998? Here's what 1998 was for me. 1998 was, let's see, my first son was born, so that was a good thing. I actually got a job in public radio, my first job in public radio, so that was also a good thing, because it led directly to me being here, which I hope is also a good thing for me and for y'all. But here's why we're really talking about 1998. You think back to 1998, and you think Bill Clinton. And you think Monica Lewinsky, and you think, oh my God, was that 20 years ago? And it was. And the really cool podcast part of this is a podcast called Slow Burn from the folks at Slate, technically Slate Plus. Leon Neyfakh is a staff writer at Slate. He is also the host of that podcast. Season one of Slow Burn, you might have heard, I hope you did because it was awesome, was about Watergate, and it was, I'm going to say, mind-bending, and that's not really too strong. Season two is about the Clinton impeachment, which was 20 years ago. And we got, so let me just say, first of all, I've heard episode one, a screener for it, if you will, and it was cool. And so we've got Leon Neyfakh here, the host, and the guy who helped produce it, and I imagine helped create it, right? Is he around? Leon, you got
you? That's right, I'm here.
this was your idea, right?
I don't know if I can take credit for the idea of making a Watergate podcast. I actually think one of my colleagues proposed it. However, his vision for it, I think, was to do something more academic and have, you know, historians come in and discuss this and that. And I think once I got on board, we took it into a more narrative direction and, you know, wanted to use archival footage and wanted to do, you know, new interviews with primary sources, people who were there and who remember it. And so, you know, to make it a sort of a story-driven project rather than an academic one. Yeah.
Not to make this all about you, because we're going to get to the podcast in a minute, but are you a history guy? I mean, is this what tickles you, doing this stuff?
Well, I have not been historically, so to speak. I guess I did major in history and literature.
well, there you go. This was so not, you kind of are a history guy.
I guess so. Yeah. I was more on the literature end of things, though. I definitely had not done any like historical journalism really before this. You know, my career in journalism has involved. Let's see. I started out covering the publishing industry for the New York Observer back when our friend Jared Kushner was in charge of it.
Yeah.
wow. And then I worked for the Boston Globe ideas section where I wrote about academic research. And then at Slate, I was covering criminal justice in the Department of Justice, which is what led me to this topic, to Watergate specifically.
Yeah. So season one, as I said, was Watergate, and it was just amazing. I'm not a binging podcast guy, but I ran through them in like 2 days. It was amazing.
Nice.
Amazingly successful.
That's how long it took to make them, too.
Yeah. the unknown secret about really good podcasts is that they take forever to make.
That's right.
So season one lands. It's amazingly successful. And what did you do? Did you start looking around for things, or was it, oh, yeah, we got to do the Clinton impeachment?
You know, it was what you just said, but in the reverse order. I think the first instinct was, well, we got to do the Clinton impeachment. And then we're like, well, do we? What's something else that we could try? Because, I don't know, to me, it felt a little bit like obvious, a little bit too similar. Like, okay, we're just going to do the other impeachment story. You know, if we do that, what do we do next? I kind of wanted to see, you know, if there was something more surprising we could do. But then I was talking to a friend of mine about it, and he was like, Leon, you are going to be so mad if someone else does it instead of
totally.
You. And
totally.
I realized he was right. And then I also realized that, like, the reason it seemed like an obvious idea is because it was an obviously good idea. And then, you know, I think what it took really to get me jazzed about it was finding out that the reason Monica Lewinsky had any occasion to cross paths with Clinton in the White House, in the Oval Office, was that she was an intern who had been elevated to have more responsibilities during a government shutdown, because all of these federal workers, including most of the White House staff, were furloughed. And so the interns had to step up. And that was sort of why she was, you know, in the mix to that extent. And that's just, I don't know, that really tickled me that like this one little, you know, sliding door could have gone the other way and maybe none of this would have ever happened.
Well, yeah. So the what if thread of history is really strong, at least in the first episode that I listened to. And that's for me, some of the cool parts of history. But I want to do a little cultural moment thing here. And I'm going to play a piece of tape from the first episode. And you guys, let's play that first cut that I asked you for.
While working on this show, I discovered that not everyone knows who Linda Tripp is. That struck me as insane. 20 years ago, Tripp was a world-famous supervillain. Her name was synonymous with treachery and manipulation. Tripp worked in the same office as Monica Lewinsky for much of 1996 and 1997. And during that time, Lewinsky spilled her guts to her colleague about the affair she was having with Clinton.
So I know the answer to this, but I'm going to ask it for the folks who don't know. And I know because I listened to the first episode. How old are you now and how old were you in 1998?
So I'm 33 now. I was in eighth grade. So like roughly, I can say less than roughly 13. I was 13.
So you say at the tail end of this podcast on the way out, you say you were vaguely aware. You sort of knew, right? What was going on?
Yeah. I mean, I remember watching the impeachment vote on TV. I remember our teacher in English class brought it in.
So in 1972, when I was 10, I remember watching the Watergate hearings. That's a spooky parallel. When I was a kid, yeah. Anyway, sorry, go ahead.
Yeah, there you go. Yeah. Well, I remember being really confused about why he was still president if he had been impeached. Like, I just didn't know that was a distinct thing from being convicted in the Senate. But yeah, that was, I suppose I was sort of absorbing it kind of ambiently, you know?
Yeah.
As I say in the show, like, my parents, you know, were Democrats, and I think I probably sort of just by osmosis kind of absorbed a loyalty to Clinton and kind of felt like he was being unfairly attacked. And, you know, I think for a lot of people when they're growing up and they're kids, you know, they kind of get their opinions or their intuitions from their parents or from elsewhere. And so I think, you know, I'm hoping that people who have that experience of the Clinton Lewinsky scandal will find something to kind of challenge those intuitions in this show.
So I wonder, just to play it out to the future a little bit, I wonder if my 14-year-old now in 20 years is going to remember Paul Manafort just because he's in the news, you know?
Yeah, Paul Manafort's a good example of someone who, you know, what's the over under on him kind of staying in the collective consciousness? I don't know. I feel like there's a lot of minor characters in the Trump universe. I feel like there's only one major character, you know.
Yeah, that's,
and everybody else is going to be clawing for what's the expression? The history's footnotes or whatever. Everyone else is going to be trying to elbow their way into that real estate. But surely they will remember Trump. I don't know about everybody else.
I don't want to give, in fact, I'm not going to give anything away, but you start episode one on the 16th of January, 1998, and you make the case through the episode. First of all, tell us why you picked that day to start.
So that was the day when it was very shortly before the scandal broke publicly. At this point, no one knew who Monica Lewinsky was, but it was the day that Lewinsky was confronted in the Pentagon City Mall in Virginia by FBI agents who took her up to a hotel room where she was told by prosecutors representing Ken Starr's Office of the Independent Counsel that she was in huge trouble because she had filed an affidavit in the Paula Jones sexual harassment civil suit stating that she had not ever been involved with the president, which was untrue. But basically, this confrontation to me, and I'm not the only one I think who has made this observation, represents kind of the fusing or the coming together of three separate threads that previously were sort of, you know, following parallel tracks. And it was because of this kind of collision of these three threads, I think I'm mixing metaphors here, that Clinton's presidency was imperiled.
And to the larger point that you make through the rest of the episode, this is arguably the pivot of some of the really hyper-partisanship that we have in this culture and in this society today.
I think so. Yeah, I think that's very fair to say that the sort of reflexive, you know, siding with your side. You know, obviously there was a lot of that under Nixon too, but it really went to a new level under Clinton. Just the bitterness of the divide got way out of hand, and I think we've been living with it ever since.
An observation just from listening all the way through to the end and the credits. You cite NBC News for providing some audio, CBS News as well, C-SPAN. I have to note here that Fox News started up in 1996, just before this, and they didn't quite have their sea legs under them, perhaps, in time to maximally take advantage for their purposes of this incident.
I think I think they did quite well with it, actually. I think, you know, by 98, they were up and running, and, you know, their coverage was very aggressive, is my understanding. The reason you didn't hear them in the credits is just because we couldn't secure any of the licensing agreements that we needed to use their clips. I think that's what happened. Anyway, we don't have Fox News in the show, unfortunately.
A word here about technology. And here comes the second piece of tape I want to play. Once again, this is from episode one of season two of Slow Burn, which drops tomorrow. And it's about the Clinton impeachment. So here it is. Here's the thing I want to hit.
Though the Newsweek story that was supposed to come out that weekend got held up by the magazine's editors, the affair soon became public knowledge anyway, thanks to a story on a previously obscure website called the Drudge Report.
Can you imagine, Leon Neyfakh, if there had been social media 20 years ago?
I can't. You know, one thing, I mean, there's a bunch of different ways in which it would have totally scrambled the events as we know them. But, you know, one thing I think that goes underappreciated is that, you know, Lewinsky wasn't just talking to Linda Tripp about the affair. She had, like, I think there were like 10 other people who knew about it.
Was that right?
In her orbit. Yeah. Just like friends of hers. So you got to wonder, like, whether, you know, she would have been writing about it. I don't know. It's obviously speculation, but I certainly imagine that she would have been tempted to. I think anyone would. But I think as far as like the news spreading, I mean, there's this incredible fact that I just still find mind-boggling, which is that the day after the events of episode one, Drudge puts up an item saying that there was this Newsweek story that had been held up about the president having an affair with an intern. And then it wasn't until January 21st, so that's Sunday, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, that's 3 or 4 days, when, you know, people knew, sort of, like people who read the Drudge Report knew, you know, maybe people in Washington were talking to each other about it. But like the Washington Post broke the story, for all intents and purposes, because and the idea that it would take that long is just
nuts.
Unthinkable today. Yeah.
Yeah,
you know, in Newsweek, you know, and Mike Isikoff, who is the Newsweek reporter who I alluded to there.
Yeah.
You know, he had the story and it was held up by editors. Once the story broke and they wanted to, you know, take advantage of the fact that he'd been working on it for months, they had to fax their story around to news organizations all around town, and they put it on their America Online website. They had nowhere to put it, you know, and then they didn't know if anyone was going to read it on there. So they just uploaded it. And I think it was, you know, probably one of the first stories to ever run online only.
Oh, my God. That's amazing.
Until it ended up in the magazine, obviously. But for a minute there, it was exclusive to the web.
On AOL. Last thing, and then I'll let you go. It was shocking to me to actually hear Monica Lewinsky's voice. And we should say you didn't talk to her. She declined to sit down with you, but you got some archival tape from one of the few public appearances she's made. It occurred to me I did not know what she sounded like before this.
Yeah, I mean, she has not been super public. I think that's changing. I think it's been changing for a couple of years. As you said, she did decline to talk to us, which we were sad about. We definitely wanted her perspective in the show, and it was, you know, quite a challenge to try to kind of tell her side of the story without hearing from her directly. But, you know, things like that speech that we excerpted, and things like, you know, she had a documentary that she made for HBO called Monica in Black and White, provided some insights. You know, there's a book about her that she cooperated with that came out shortly after the scandal. There's interviews that she's given, you know, that you think she talked to Barbara Walters, you know, sometime after the scandal. So, you know, there's some sort of primary source material out there to draw on. But certainly it does, you know, there's a hole in our podcast where Monica Lewinsky would be. But hopefully, you know, hopefully we make up for it in other ways.
Episode one, I will tell you, is a treat. It's from Slate Plus. It's called Slow Burn. Leon Neyfakh, thanks a lot. I really appreciate it.
Hey, thanks for having me. I really appreciate your time.
Take it easy. We're going to take a break straight ahead. Of course, you can always email us about the things you are smart about. And if one of them happens to be, by the way, the Clinton impeachment, hit us up with that too. That's makemesmart@marketplace.org. You can tweet at us. I'm at Kai Rizdahl. Molly, if she is on Twitter on vacation, first of all, I'm going to yell at her, even though, yes, I did not delete Twitter on my own vacation, but she's at Molly Wood. Give it a whack. Maybe she'll answer you. Who knows? Also, actually, before I forget, Tony Wagner put together a neat little timeline and sort of cast characters for the Clinton impeachment and all of that stuff. Check it out on the website, makemesmart.org. Tony hooked us up. A little break right here, and then we hear from you. All right, here we go. Now it is time to hear from you.
Hi, Kai and Molly.
This is Brent in Detroit.
This is Rebecca from Baltimore.
It was great to hear comments on my question about GDPR.
I wanted to put in my vote.
I want to discuss a slightly different but maybe related thing.
That's what we do. Slightly different, but maybe related. A couple of you had questions about last week's trade war episode. Justin Martin emailed with this question. He said, who benefits from the proceeds of tariffs? I know the consumer will ultimately pay the price for rising costs, but does the government take in the actual profit from the tariff? A couple of things. Number one, tariffs are taxes. So we should get that nomenclature right. Taxes are generally paid by consumers in this economy, by and large. So yes, consumers pay the ultimate cost of the tariffs. That money does eventually wind up in the government's coffers. But look, here's the deal. And we talked about this on Marketplace this week. Tracy Samuelson did a great piece. The federal budget debt is $21 trillion, plus or minus. We are now putting tariffs on maybe $50 billion worth of stuff, maybe a little bit more. The upshot of which is to say, look, the net proceeds, profits, if you will, from the tariffs, which are paid by American consumers, one more time, is not going to do anything to the actual federal deficit, to the federal debt, or in any meaningful way affect the government's finances. That is not why they have been imposed by the president. Parker Law had some thoughts about last week's little back and forth we had about bourbon and whether it is going to get more expensive due to the tariffs. Molly and I pretty much got it wrong, but Parker had this to say in a voice memo.
Now, as to whether or not prices for Americans will go up, it's not an easy question to answer. I used to manage the barrel aging process at an American craft distillery. Whiskey gets more valuable as it gets older. Therefore, if sales are down, the whiskey can just be left in the barrel and gain more value in delicious flavor. Usually, sometimes too much of a good thing can cause problems, and it also evaporates over time. My guess is that demand is still higher than what companies have in their aging warehouses, especially the older whiskeys in the luxury market, which are frequently exported. For a company that has to think decades in advance, it will take a while for the effects of tariffs to reach the consumer, if they ever do. And in fact, some of those luxury whiskeys might even go down in price.
All right, well, there you go. So Molly and I, not only did we not have it right the first time, we might not have had it right the second time. But, you know, you guys know more than we do, and that's the way this podcast rolls. Finally, I think it's finally right. Yes, I'm looking at the rundown. Ichijioka, and we're saying finally, by the way, because we figure if you're just listening to me, you want less of me than you want of me and Molly. Ichijioka from Newbury Park, California, here in Southern California, left us this message about the trade deficit.
Hey, Kai and Molly, make me smart. When U.S. sells treasury bonds overseas, does the sale count toward the national trade deficit? Or is it just the interest in the future? Just wondering. Keep up the good work. Thanks. Bye.
Excellent question, but I think you're confusing two terms there, Itch. The first is the national trade deficit, which is the amount of money the United States owes for money it's borrowed, which is through U.S. Treasury debt, which I think you're referring to. The other is the trade gap or the trade deficit, which is a completely different thing, which is the difference between how much we buy from overseas and how much we sell to overseas. That is the thing you hear the president talking about all the time. So when Treasury bonds sell overseas, or domestically for that matter, it is added to the national debt because we are saying, in effect, to the people who buy a 10-year note or a 3-year note or a 1-month note or a 30-year note, we are saying, please lend us your $100 or whatever denomination you prefer to buy, and we will pay you back in the future with some appropriate interest rate. So, yeah, that adds to the national debt. That's kind of the way that thing works. But it's a good question, and it's also important to differentiate between the trade gap and the federal deficit and the federal debt, because that's a different thing. All right, we're out of here. We are going. That was quick. What was that? 19 minutes and 30 seconds. How about that? Write to us, makemesmart@marketplace.org. You can get us on Twitter. I'm at Kai Rizdahl. Molly's at Molly Wood. Also, let me just get another plug in here for Slow Burn, because it's so good, and it makes you sit there and go, holy cow, man, history matters. History freaking matters, which is kind of my gig. Anyway, Molly did the whole outro last week. This week, it is my turn because she's not here. And if I wasn't doing it, nobody would do it. Subscribe to the podcast and Apple Podcasts or wherever you like. Tell us a friend. Leave us a rating or a comment. And we'll read them because we do, because it matters. Make Me Smart is produced by Sharon Morris. The senior producer is Eve Tro. Tony Wagner is our digital producer. This week's program was engineered by Jake Gorski. Our theme music was composed by Ben Talladay and Daniel Ramirez. The executive director of On Demand is Sitar Nieves. The senior vice president and general manager is Deborah Clark. Look at that. Trained radio professional. I'd drop the mic, except the engineers would yell at me.